Well, this is Dennis Emery. I'm here with the Kentucky Hall of Fame Tennis Podcast, and today's guest is Meg Peavy. And Meg, before we get into the podcast and into the interview, I have a distinct memory of you, and that memory was when you went into the Hall of Fame, and everybody in the place stood up and cheered, and it was just so genuine, you know, and it just reminded me how many people you must have impacted over all these years in Louisville. And I don't remember that type of reception for other people. And, you know, as I say, they're just so genuinely happy for you. But that comes at the end of the story. And tell me the beginning of the story. Tell me, how did you get started in tennis?
I was the original, as I indicated to you earlier, the original S&H green stamp kid. I was sent up on my bike to, had divorced parents, so things were a little bit tight monetarily. And I was sent up with these, some of your older people might recall, S&H green stamp books. You stuck stamps in them and you could go get various things at a certain store. I was sent up on my bike to go get a toaster. That said, toaster never made it home, because I went to the store and upon looking around, this guy had a red and white Wilson racket hanging on the wall. And I had been given a racket to use by an older gentleman at a park called Myers Park for about 2 days to use, and he had to take it back because he had to play in a tournament. He later was one of my mentors. So I spy this Wilson racket that was probably cheap as all get out, but to me it was like phenomenal.
How old were you at this point?
I was 11, which is relatively late for tennis, I'm told. But so 11 years old, I'm like, Mr. Peterson, how many books is that? He goes, well, that's 2.5, and I had 2.5. I said, how much is the toaster? He goes, well, that's 2.5. I said, can I have the racket instead? He goes, did your mother send you out for that? sort of, you know, yes, sir. Not, no, well, no, no, she did not. He goes, well, why are you here, Meg? And I said, well, I'm supposed to get a toaster, but I'd rather have that racket. And so he gives me a special look. He says, okay, takes off the wall and hands it to me. He goes, it'll bear a little secret, but you owe me. I said, okay, fine. So I ride back and I get home, and mom's like, you know, several hours later, she comes home from work and she goes, well, where's the toaster? And I said, they're out of them. Just right to your face. They're out of them. And she's like, they're out of toasters? Which is relatively far-fetched of an idea. And she said, that's strange. And so I said, well, you know, I guess they're just out of them. And thought, well, I'll just call up and check. I thought, okay, I'm dead. I'm dead. So she called Mr. Peterson. I'm in the back of the trailer with almost on my knees, my hands crossed, saying, please, Mr. Peterson, just this one time, like maybe just fudge a little. And so he did. He goes, no, Helen, I don't expect another truck in a couple of weeks or so. And we just don't have any. And I thought, oh my goodness, there must be a sign. So with that, the rest is history. So
yeah. So you say he became your mentor. Was he a tennis player?
He actually didn't play too much tennis, but the man who lent me his racket to begin with was a gentleman named Conway Skinner, who was an evangelical minister, of all things. I did not know what that meant nor what that entailed when I first met him. I just thought he looked like an apparition. He was dressed in white trousers, a white long tunic, which I know is a fancy word, but I knew that as a kid, and a hat. And I thought, okay, so would you like to try to play tennis? And I said, I was hitting on the backboard playing foursquare, basically, and with a kickball. And I was playing badminton the day before that when he heard me probably cussing up a blue storm as to how inadequate my partner was at the time, and we're not going to win if you don't play better. He just heard this jibber-jabber. Uh-huh. So he says, well, young lady, why don't you come up here a few steps up? The courts are just up a couple of stairs in Tallahassee, Florida. He says, try this game. The court's bigger, and you might enjoy it more because you can play it by yourself. And I said, okay, I'll try. Two instances, Dennis, occurred to me very quickly. One, I fell in love with this thunk, the sound that the strings made with hitting this little ball. And we were only playing at that point short court. I didn't know that term, but that I know that now. And two, how bloody hot my feet were because I had holes in my shoes. And I was dancing around. He goes, oh, you move your feet really well. I'm like, oh, little do you know, sir. It is not about me having good footwork. It's about my feet are on fire, so I have to keep moving them. So he thought that was charming. So he goes, so he let me have his little racket. And he goes, I'm going to pick it up on Monday of a tournament. I said, okay, fine. Well, he came, and I was so disconsolate. I had little tears in my eyes. He goes, that's okay. I'll come back, and I'll bring another one for you. And the next day, Eureka, was the toaster day. So after the toaster day, I went back up to the backboard. I could ride my bike. It was 5 miles, but to a kid, that's nothing. Rode back and just beat the hell out of the backboard because the backboard doesn't speak back. never misses, doesn't quit, rain or shine, he's always there. And that's how I began my little career.
So. Yeah. When did you start playing tournaments?
At 12. Actually, I was only 11, so within about 6 months, I'm not saying I'm a phenom, but come on, if you could keep scoring, hit a ball back and forth, you could play in the 12s. And Tallahassee had a neat little tennis scene with almost like you would call in Louisville, I learned, was called the patron system.
Uh-huh.
And in Tallahassee, which I keep trying to make major universities up here try and do, the recreation department kids who are getting a degree at FSU had to work in a park for a summer as part of their degree. So every park you got dropped off, whether it be Winthrop Park or Myers Park, what have you, you could be dropped off there from 7 to 5 and have supervision. So my brother and I were both dropped off, hence the courts and the badminton snafu.
Uh-huh.
So I began that. One of the kids on this directorship was a tennis player from FSU. So she started tapping balls with me. And then Mr. Conway Skinner came back after his tournament and was a fine player. He was a missionary in Africa for 44 years. So he's already in his early 70s. And again, as an 11-year-old, I didn't know what that meant. But he loved to play, had a very smooth game. Might want to call my style was very traditional. Like I have an Eastern forehand grip to this day and a one-handed backhand and that kind of thing. So he taught me how to play and very quickly taught me how to keep score, which I think is important because if you have an idea what the score is when you rally, you have a little more appreciation of the game itself instead of just going and hitting. And so I began to play in some little just intermediate tournaments around the city in these public parks, much like you would in Lexington or Louisville. All the public parks have tournaments. It's like maybe a $3 entry fee, which is a fortune, but I made it. And just began to get really pretty good pretty quick. And so then I was on like a little city team, and then we would go and play Jacksonville, we'd play St. Augustine, we'd play Panama City, we'd play Pensacola. And we were in the northern part of the state, so we were considered lesser than players with all due respect. When you hit Gainesville and above, we were a little sketchy. When you went past south of Gainesville, you know, the Schwabs and Paula Schwab and all the people in Naples and Sarasota and Miami, those are the players, you know. So we had to make our way through that. Because Florida is so big, it has a sub-district. It has a northern and southern district, which is, you'd imagine. And even 4,000 years ago, it did. And as a young player, I went pretty far in tennis. And then I played in this giant tournament. The FSU girls took a shining to me. It was good to have a college, big university in my city. And we went up to play in a thing called the Crackerland Championships.
Right.
Which my mother thought was an abhorrent title because she was understanding what Crackerland actually meant. But that's another story. Having to do with white people, but we'll digress there. So I went up to play at the University of Georgia in Athens and did really well as a women's tournament and a big women's event. And played with an FSU player named Nancy Shattuck, who's tell a dear friend of mine, and she lives in Chicago, and she was a very good player. And then one of the pros took a shining to me, and I worked in his pro shop, and he gave me lessons. And so it was like definitely a village. You know, it's one of those, it takes a village to get me where the hell I'm supposed to go. And so with all these people that were like touchstones, I just know that I could not have made it monetarily. Tennis was still going to cost some money and had nice people pay for entry fees. I was housed in a lot of tournaments. I would go to, you know, Louisiana, I would go to New Orleans or Baton Rouge or name that tune Atlanta or South Carolina, and people would house me in these tournaments that I played in. And you know,
did you travel in a group when
I traveled on a Greyhound bus. So the story about that was, and it sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm not. I would sit behind the bus driver all the way from the 12s and 14s on, and I would read my little Nancy Drew books or whatever the hell I was reading, and I would get off at the city, and the people would pick me up, and then I would be at their house. They would take me back. They were like, "Need we take you to the airport?" I'm like, "No, ma'am, just take me to the bus station." They were like somewhat appalled, I'm sure. But it worked. I knew that Greyhounds are north and south and Trailways are east and west. I mean, I knew my buses, so I kind of knew which to get on. But people were super nice, and to be housed, the people I did play with their daughters. Sometimes they were not the most stellar players, I have to admit, but it didn't matter because they're lovely people, and they housed me, and I got, you know, all my meals, and many times I had a pool in the backyard, which to me was such an extravagance. Certainly beats a creek, and I loved going to those places, and the people were still lifelong friends. I still know some of the people. They've since passed away. They're older, but I still know the daughters that I play with from all over the Southeast, and it's just been it was an interesting travel because to meet people even on a bus. I met more people on buses, Dennis, who you only knew them for a short period of time when they would get off. I was on like the long haul between whatever city I was in until I reached Tallahassee. Might be 12 hours on that bus. And I might have had to change buses, but the bus drivers are really good about, okay, get off here, young lady, and you get on that bus and off you go. And I had a ticket, so that's all you have to have. And that was lovely. I mean, nothing ever happened to me, ever. There were very lovely people that were on the bus that would talk to me. Older people. I love to talk to older people. I think they have such wisdom. I love to hear stories about how they grew up, many of them very poor. Bus people are a certain ilk that, now some people do a bus just to say, I want to experience a bus, but these are people that probably, for the most part, use buses because it was their transportation device. And it will get you all over the country if you know how to work the system. And I feel like if you can do that under the age of 18, okay, you're rocking because you can go anywhere on a bus. And so that was my trip into tennis until I went to college.
What would you say was the highlight of your junior career?
I would say the Crackerland tournament, because it was one of the first eye-opening experiences of playing as a 16-year-old in the women's events, and gained some notoriety a little bit in my hometown, so a lot of the pros started trying to hit with me and work with me some, and they knew who I was, but they never really saw me play as well they shouldn't. And then I went to a lot of women's tournaments in Pensacola at the Pensacola Racquet Club and went down to Naples, Florida, and into Miami. So I went to, matter of fact, I tried some of the, back in the day, Virginia Slims tours where you could pay $150 as your, quote, bond. They called it an entry, but if you knew how it worked, you're bonded to the next tournament. So if you won a round in that tournament, it would bond you to the next one. Uh-huh. And as that money ran out or you lost, then you lost your money, which is catastrophic. But I did that until I got to college, and went to a junior college in Florida called Central Florida Community College, which I know people laugh about. How'd you go to a JUCO? But you and I both know what JUCOs meant. Uh-huh. For instance, the mighty UK came down, and we beat them 6-3. The mighty U of L came down, which wasn't very mighty, and we blew them out 9-0 in about an hour. And Ann Schmidt will tell you that was a blowout. She was Ann Flaherty then, and so that's how I met some dear friends of mine. So this junior college, we women had kids. We had people from Canada, one from South America, because that was your international entree into college tennis. Right. You had to compete in junior colleges first and then matriculate to a four-year school. So I had people with me as a younger player that were very wise, even though I did play number one, but their experiences are so nice to me to learn, and the languages we picked up a little bit. And then my men's team, we had people watching our men's team have practice. I mean, I have to admit, the short shorts were a bit of a draw, and the no shirt, wow, that we had trouble practicing sometimes because we were looking the other way. Yeah. Let's say, and we practiced at the same time. As junior college players, we had to do work study. It was part of your scholarship thrown in. And we taught tennis at night. All 18 of us, all 9 in the women's team and 9 in the men, and taught local people in Ocala, Florida, which is a really rich little city because of horses. It is the southern city of Lexington. Right. It's where all the horses go back and forth on I-75. So I had this amazing little idyllic junior college transformation in tennis, which is huge tennis to play, and an amazingly well-to-do city that could sponsor our tennis mentorship. We had 100 people a night to learn how to play tennis. And it was in stations. You taught a forehand or a backhand or whatever, et cetera. But in so doing, at that junior college, I was a sports writer. I was a writer for the paper, not just sports, but everything. But I got to write for my high school paper, then I wrote for the junior college paper, and that portfolio, because I wrote about important people in that city, I think helped me get my leg up at the Courier Journal. My entry into the University of Louisville was not tennis, with all due respect, it was journalism. The Courier Journal was a huge paper back in the day because of its morning and evening edition. And as such, to be a young writer, if your portfolio was accepted and you could just sweep the floor at the Courier Journal, if you could just get in to do that, you're around Pulitzer Prize winning writers. You know, Michael Wines and others, David Hopp being the editor, he was one of my professors. So going to U of L was a double-edged sword. It was a great thing. It was great tennis. I got to play one, got a nice scholarship to play. But my love of what I did, other than tennis, of course, was because I saw the journalistic trade. I mean, I saw a top 10 newspaper. People don't realize that. It was up with the San Francisco Chronicle, the Miami Herald, the Dallas Tribune, I mean, the New York Times. It was in that top 10. The Louisville paper was, I didn't know where Louisville was, but I heard of the paper before. So that was interesting.
So how did you get recruited at the junior college originally?
Joan Fielding came down to see me play. And she thought, well, who are you? And you talk way too quickly to be from the South. And I said, well, my mother's a Yankee, so there's that, from Rhode Island. But she saw me playing. She liked my style. And I had some other coaches from milling around, with all due respect. UK was a little bit looking. But also Missouri. Again, I was kind of pigeonholing me personally for journalism. And Mizzou has a great journalism program.
Yes, they do.
Columbia University in New York. I know it sounds funny. Am I that good? I was pretty good. But also, they weren't as good. I mean, it's one of those things where I probably could have played at Columbia. I mean, the lady was there, and I liked the journalism program, but even their scholarships were so inefficient or insufficient for my lack of monetary means to make it in Manhattan. I mean, they were going to give me a nice scholarship, but it was so much more expensive, and, you know, just the travel and just the room and board and stuff was too much. So And I liked Mizzou. I mean, the coach was nice, but I thought, with all due respect, Missouri was more of a less of a city than Louisville. Louisville had such a history, and the more I read about it, it seemed very interesting. And the Courier Journal, again, that was the deal breaker. So those schools offered me some scholarships, and I chose the Courier Journal, and I chose Louisville, sight unseen. I never saw the school.
Now, Joan Fielding was the coach.
Yes, she was like her third year.
In her third year.
So she had Kathy Ramsey on the team, who was from Louisville, who played at Murray State, who transferred back in. And so these ladies I met on the team, I know them to this day, Ann Flaherty, who is now Ann Schmidt, and Kathy Ramsey are on that team. And so they were the two that I got to know a little bit. And they were supposed to take me to the student union on our campus to talk to me about, don't I want to play for them? Well, Kathy, I don't think she made it to that little Coke trip that we had. So instead, Ann Flaherty came and said, I don't think she really wants to play at U of L. Well, how could you blame her? She's like, what am I, stupid? This lady just blew me out. You think I'm going to want her to play here? Uh-huh. So we have this on-running joke about, you know, she told Coach Fielding that I don't think she's really that interested. So, I mean, I think that's smart. I think that's self-preservation. I think I would have done the same thing. No, she's not that interested. So then Joan, after they played us in March, we played the junior college championships at St. Pete. At St. Leo Junior College, which has a lot of courts, and we could use USF's courts, so it's a very nice place to play. And I was playing in the Junior College Championships, and Joan came down for that, along with these other coaches. I mean, in those days, you had Miami-Dade, you know, you had Broward, you had Indian River. These are some sophisticated, you know. We played Playboy from Tyler, Texas. We beat them, and that's a big junior college. So we beat some pretty big people. So that was Junior College Nationals being played there. So I did well in that, and so that's made some of the scholarship offers presentable, and I had to pick and choose a little bit, and I'm to this day very grateful. I mean, my first love might have been, with all due respect, Dennis, Manhattan. Who would turn that down? Uh-huh. But I just knew that physically, it was physically just impossible to do that. But Louisville was by far the next best choice because great journalism, very historic city, and it's grown a lot, as you know, since I've been here for 4,000 years. But in terms of just the school itself, I never saw it. I just trusted that it was an okay university. I've been there since 1798. I'm thinking, looks like Harvard. I was greatly mistaken, but that's okay. Yeah, it all worked out.
Yeah. So how long did Joan coach at U of L?
Only for 3 more years, because my first year of graduate school, remember, I came in as a junior college player, so I had my little associate's degree in English, and I matriculated up to U of L, journalism major. And she was there for only 3 years, and my 2 years in my first year of graduate school, her kids, she has 3 kids, and they're all getting to an age where they really needed her attention to get them to places and all of that. So Bill Olson said, well, just be the coach for a year. I'm like, I don't want to be the coach here. Those are my friends. I'm not going to – that's weird to have your peers that you just graduated from only 1 year removed. Suddenly you're going to tell them how far to run, how high to jump, you know. Because I knew a little bit about how to be a coach, but that was not my ilk. I was going to be a famous writer, so why would you ask me? So I did it for a year. Well, somehow you had to put a 2 in the front, so I ended up being there 22 years. And I was like, whatever. I don't know how that happened, but oh well. But I did get my degree in journalism. I was a string reporter for the Courier. I wrote some stories from the courthouse. The district courthouse in Louisville has a lot of excitement. It has divorces and evictions and homicides and trade papers that go wrong, anyway. But it was an interesting focal point to be a young cub reporter. So in the day, you would run to a phone, literally a pay phone, so I'm doubting myself, and I call in a little story to the editor. It wasn't always David, it was just the city desk editor, so-and-so, dun-dun-dun, and you jot things down, and then they would take the story and run with it. And you never got any credit because you didn't have a byline. I mean, we knew what we did, but only the writers could put the story together.
Right.
Now, occasionally, in the next 12 years after I graduated, they started using the term staff writer, which is still not a person. You're not a person yet because you have your name in the paper. But it is an honorable thing to do. And so I did get my feet wet as a writer and knew that I could maybe perhaps go on and do that. But then college tennis was all-consuming. It's a one-woman show. I have no trainer. I had no assistant, just me, for those 22 years. Nobody. No assistant. Now, at the very end, dear Mark Beckham helped us out because the athletic director thought, we need to make sure we cover our shoes here, with all due respect, and give women's tennis an associate coach and or an assistant coach. So Mark helped out with that, which is a good thing because, as it turns out, as I was moving on to do other things because COVID hit and all that, he took over that program and has done great guns. So I think it was a good – and he was Rex's assistant for like a dozen years.
Right.
So he knew how to run a team. He knew how to run practices, how to drive the van, the whole bit. So I think it was a very good thing in the sense that it groomed him to, and it has daughters, so, you know, and women are weird to coach, as you well know. They're just a little different than men. I'll tell this famous story. You can tell, in my humble opinion, you can tell a men's team to go off and run for a mile, and they'll just go. Women's teams might look at you funny and might want to ask, why? And then they'll do it. You know, so there's just a different makeup with women athletes, I think, than men.
Right. So your playing days at U of L, what do you remember about that? Was there any highlights that jumped out at you?
My playing days, I think, again, playing UK was always good because it was a big state rivalry.
Did you beat UK?
I did not beat Susan. and I do think I beat the next young lady. I can't remember who it was, though, but whoever, 1980, whoever that was. Uh-huh. I have to go back and look. But that was good. But also just the travel we did, even in those couple of years, we went to my first vaccination to go to Hilton Head. Uh-huh. Tennis, you know, which rocks anyway, tennis really did coin the phrase spring March Madness because we had, to this day, we had 300 teams invade Hilton Head. All divisions, 1, uh-huh. 2, and 3, take over every court you can imagine, go in every villa you could throw 8 kids in, and play matches every day of the week. And you could have matches at 8, 12, and 4. And so as soon as I finished doing that as a player, I mean, we would play teams like NYU or Worcester, or we'd play University of Illinois would come down to that because uh-huh. you could just get such good tennis in one place. And it's fairly good weather. March is decent weather. It might have been 50 or 60, but gosh, compared to snowing, that was good. Mm-hmm. So I always took my teams down there. It was a neat place to travel and to meet other coaches and meet other teams you could never get to play. And then we would take a sweep through Florida. Every other year we did Hilton Head and then Florida. So those two experiences in college from Joan helped us sort of help me make a pathway to guide my team around to play teams we would never have gotten to play. USF would never come to us. It's too far. You know, back in the day, you have quads now because of conferences. But in those days, we're in the Metro Conference. It was big cities like Houston, you know, DePaul and Chicago. Right. You know, gosh, what was it? UNC, Charlotte. Memphis. They were just big cities, and you just couldn't get them to play a match. So whereas the conference now helps you financially do that, they'll say, you have to go play this pod, and you go play that pod, et cetera. But in the day, you had to try to make your way to other teams before you saw them at the tournament. Otherwise, it was just like walk in and play the tournament. So there was that.
Was there a big win that stood out for you in your college?
I think when I beat the lady from Ohio State because she was thought playing at Triangle Park was a joke. And that was really our secret weapon. Again, long before there were trains, planes, and automobiles in a movie, we had them at Triangle Park. Uh-huh. Because you would have every day planes, they change the runway, you know, the planes would go over ahead to Sanford Field to land. And they almost hit you in the head. Then a train would go right on CSX, right uh-huh. by 3rd Street, cross over 3rd Street. And then you'd have a wreck on 3rd Street, probably once a day, because some truck would not read that stupid train trestle that says 7.8 feet and you don't fit. Boom. So a semi would be caught under the truck. So there'd be a traffic buildup. And then the Southern Police Institute would let out right across the street from us. A bunch of 30, 40-year-old, which were considered old men at that time, would whistle and catcall all the time we're trying to play. And we're just oblivious. We're just like playing tennis. And Ohio State is looking around like, what in the hell have we gotten ourselves into? Where are we? Are we like in outer space? Where is this place? Mm-hmm. So that was a great win for me because I entrust my surroundings as part of the weapon because she could not deal with all the distractions.
Well, so you played your matches at Triangle Park.
All whopping 2 years, yes. Yeah. And Rex. Rex did the same thing.
Okay, yeah. And Rex played there?
And Ann.
So. And then you take over as coach. Mm-hmm. How long were you the coach before the indoor facility, the
Bass Rudd? We built Bass Rudd in 95, and I started coaching in 83, so about a dozen years.
Gosh, 12.
We literally had to almost mow the grass on the courts, literally. I mean, I didn't know what Roundup was as a kid. I know what Roundup was now because you could drop it on all the grass to kill the weeds in between the courts. Because, you know, as you know, Triangle Park was essentially a clay court system, just like Seneca was in the city. Uh-huh. A lot of early Louisville city parks had clay courts. Right. And the deal was you would brush the court with that little piece of chain link fence when you were done. You'd drag the court. Then the people who came on to play next would literally, with the broom, sweep the lines. And that was all over the city, I'm told. I read about all this. I'm a bit of a historian like you. So I know that they were actually clay courts. And I swear they just scraped the clay off and said, here, play on the concrete. Because we had little pitted places all over the courts. And you could sometimes find clay in the very back of the fence. So it wasn't an astronomical conclusion to come to that they were at once clay courts. But they were never resurfaced. So we were playing in the white lines and the gray concrete, which made for interesting colors, and then white ball. But so in Ohio State, and other teams would come down and have to realize they have to park over on the grass on 3rd Street. No restrooms. Oh, yes, there's restrooms. Risk your life crossing 3rd Street and go change in the law school, their lounge. And the coaches would look at you like, okay, you know, I know you're just kidding. I'm like, I'm not kidding. That's all we have. And they're like, okay, fine. So it was quite an experience either being an athlete there, being a student athlete to play there, and then actually coaching there for a dozen years, employing U of L to please find something else for us to do. Now, practice-wise, when it was bad weather, well, thank goodness for Chuck Cooper. He would let us practice inside LTC. Uh-huh. Mind you, from 9 to 11 p.m., but nonetheless, yes, it was good. And then our dear Greg Stevenson, who I'm just still distraught about his passing a few weeks ago, he would let us play at Campus Tennis Club in the afternoon when the sun was still out, so that was nice. But those two things, you just bartered and try to make it work, and they gave us some indoor time, and we're grateful for that. But
so after 12 years, you get the Bass Rudd Tennis Center.
Absolutely.
What did that mean to you and your program?
Well, it certainly helped recruiting, but I'd like to say that I think the university was its best recruit. I think that if you're a big-time player, there were a lot of facilities that had, you all had Hillary Boone forever. I mean, Vanderbilt had their place, you know. I mean, a lot of big schools that needed their facilities already had them. Syracuse had something. A lot of places that we would compete against. But in terms of the university, I think the physical therapy program was a big draw. We had occupational therapy. We had the physical therapy program and all the things that a lot of young ladies would like to go into, speech therapy, those kinds of things. And not to mention the 9 professional schools, business, medicine, you name it, music, the whole bit. So the university was, to me, my biggest draw. I could show them a good university in a fair-sized city. You're living at around the university, so it's not quite, with all due respect, the West End. It wasn't someplace that the young ladies felt unsafe, and so I think it was a big draw. Our tennis center coming in was just a feather in the cap. It gave them a place to think, wow, I could actually play here. I think it helped me internationally get some kids' attention that I was not aware of, that Rex had helped me get. This brother's coming, his sister plays, you know, there's that. So I had a few kids from Russia that came in. We had some kids from Sheffield, England, a couple of kids from South America, from Brazil. And I think that that was also, that might have been enough of an incentive to, here they are, like me earlier, choosing schools. That might have been enough of an incentive to say, wow, this is a brand new tennis center. So why don't I try to play tennis with Coach Peavy, which is a good draw. But I do think that for women in particular, it may not have been the enormous stepping stone that it might have been difference to the men.
Right.
Fewer scholarships for men, way more people competed for men's tennis. And if you can get them in with that draw, I know that for Rex it was a godsend because it was such a big thing for the men's tennis that we're probably going to do more high collegiate tennis into the pros.
Uh-huh.
With all due respect, we had more high collegiate tennis into the professional life.
Right.
They wanted to be lawyers. My young women wanted to be teachers. They wanted to be dentists, that kind of thing. And it doesn't mean that they didn't aspire to be pro tennis, but they were of the ilk that if you did that, you're probably looking at a Stanford or USC or South Florida, someplace that was year-round tennis, nonstop the whole time. And I think Louisville was the biggest draw, again, for me, with my women, was more academically set it, you know, in terms of what you're going to get as a degree, how you could, who you know can help you get into grad school, that kind of small city, big time kind of thing was something I could convince their parents if they went into another endeavor like education instead of just tennis, that it, we would have a pathway to help them do that. And I think that was very valuable. But we loved having it. We loved hosting tournaments. We loved hosting fundraisers. We loved hosting my Rising Stars kids. So we had autism camps. We had wheelchair camps. The university was, that tennis center was everything to us as far as outreach. I think that was my biggest tool, if you will, that the Bass Rudd Tennis Center gave me was outreach.
And we'll go into that in a minute. But academically, you know, obviously that was a big deal for you. 99% of your players graduated,
yes.
Is that right?
The only two that didn't graduate from U of L in terms of having to change because physical therapy was dropped. So Kelly Cook, who's a very good, very dear friend of mine, she's now a high school coach, which is like the thing just keeps turning, and her son plays tennis, and Rex knows her. And she came up to see us at a big regional tournament her son played in, and she had to follow the physical therapy program because she had to go back to Miami to finish because
right.
they dropped it. And then one young lady, you know, you can't control everybody's behavior and people have to make their own choices. And one young lady just fell through the cracks, again with a slightly off-track kind of group, and we just couldn't really reel her back in. So she didn't actually graduate from U of L. But she did graduate. She's now a nurse. But technically speaking, I can't count her as a graduate of our program, but those are the only two. So I'm very proud about that.
And you should be.
Yeah.
Who would you say was the best player you coached in college?
Julie Guess, I think, is not to be overlooked.
Uh-huh.
As far as sheer talent and grit, and she was itty-bitty, you know, a whopping maybe 5'2 on a good day, but just as a dragon slayer, just slayed people that seemed to have more talent, that seemed to have more power, almost a almost like a Halep might be able to demean and diminish a Sabalenka at times if she plays well, to balance their power, how to suffuse their power, how to take their power away from them and get one more ball back and make them hit a backstop with the next forehand. I think Kelly Whitler, who lives in this city, who's from here, was an extremely underrated player, again, from Indiana, across the river. We found fabulous players over there. Of course, I didn't coach Robin White. I would absolutely jump up in town and say Robin White, but she was after I left coaching, which is unfortunate, but it was that's just the timing of how life goes. Another young lady, Katie McLaughlin, just set the world on fire from Tequesta, Florida. And she did really well in one of the last regional tournaments that we played in for the conference. She beat South Florida. She beat a lot of good players down there. But those three sort of jump out as far as Manish Patel. Cannot forget her in that she was a glorious player, was a record setter. These all played one for me. Ironically, you're going to mention the people who played one. Uh-huh. Kelly Whitler actually did not, but she played number one doubles. And she was the anchor probably between two and three for me that just anchored people. I didn't have Kathy Ramsey as my... only as my teammate, not as my player. I certainly would mention her. She has incredible records. I know that a lot of the kids went on to try to have to try to get into the 100 club win, which is this little thing we have at U of L to try to make kids pushing hard. And I think Katie might have made it. I think Julie Guest might have made it. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the records lately, Dennis. But they're often very kind to remind me, yeah, Coach, but you did it in 2 years. It took us all four. I said, well, that's not really the point. But the idea that it's still something that you strive for. And those four brought such integrity to tennis. They were very honest players. They fought and scratched every point. They weren't going to give anything. But I never had to wrestle their behavior. I never had to, you know, sit them down and say, you're not behaving, and you're representing the university and yourself and me and behave. That was, and it doesn't mean women don't have a temper. I've had people chuck rackets like the best of them. I also want to mention that in that same ilk, we had the marvelous Nadia Carpel, one of the international players that played for us. And she beat USC. She beat South Carolina. Arlo comes up and goes, where did you get that player from? I said, wouldn't you like to know? So, some of my claim to fame. But you know, you're walking in, here's Louisville, and it doesn't mean South Carolina doesn't appreciate our talent, but we're not supposed to beat them. And when you're starting to win at one and you're starting to make three nervous and you're taking court six and he's starting to rub his hands together, like, well, this isn't so funny anymore. And that's when he mentioned, who's Nadia, right? So it was, those are probably the four or five that I think are just my stellar players in terms of just to play a high level of tennis for the 4 years that are here.
So. You know, college coaches, they
like picking your kids. I was like trying to pick a kid. Yeah.
Yeah, they have a myriad of jobs, as you referred to earlier. But, you know, recruiting obviously is a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. And now that you're, now that you don't have any competition, how did you get Nadia Carpel?
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, her dad is the Russian national volleyball coach on the Olympic team. They were in Louisville for some sort of quasi-Olympic show-off thing that came in as a precursor to something they did in Chicago with some the big volleyball is huge in Louisville, so they had a bunch of – they filled up, I think it was either the Yum Center, I want to say it was, or maybe Freedom Hall, something huge with volleyball. And he was a very stern, very scary man, but he had this young blonde lady in tow, which is his daughter. He goes, so he told our athletic director, Tom, I think it was, well, I have this young daughter who'd like to play tennis. He goes, I'll hook you up. So Nadia saw the school, met some of the team, clearly an unofficial visitation because she just came with her father, I'm sure looking at other schools as well. And of some other places that they did on this volleyball tour, she kept harking back to Louisville. And I think because our girls are very nice and made her feel at home and they're fun, she liked it, so she chose Louisville. So she sort of fell into our lap. I did not get to travel to Moscow. I didn't see her play at the U.S. Open Juniors. That wasn't it, but she sort of fell in our lap. But yeah. She was a great gift. She is now a Mary Carrillo-type ESPN broadcaster in Russia for their ESPN version of our ESPN. So very successful, beautiful, blonde. I mean, knockout. So.
What is Manisha Patel doing now?
Manisha Patel, we can rub it in a little. We, you know, I worked at Ottoman Country Club for years. I don't have the girls over, and they can jump in the pool a few times on a Monday when the club is closed. And they're like, and they see the ladies have their lunches and their 7.2 children, and they're, oh, Coach, we're never going to be these ladies. You know, they don't do anything. They just have lunch all day, and their husbands work, and like, this, we will not be these people. Dot, dot, dot. Manisha now is married to a physician. She lives in Baton Rouge, large Indian community, and she is one of those ladies. She goes and plays tennis at the country club. Her children swim in the pool. She plays maybe a little golf. I'm not sure. Probably some pickleball by now. And I'm sure Kelly Marie Miller and I will kid her to death about saying, what happened to you? Because you're one of these country club people now. So that's what she does.
Well, I recruited Nero and Vimal,
yes.
You know, her brother.
Yes.
And, you know, Nero went to Georgia, and Vimal went to Stanford, and NCAA
yep.
finalist
yes.
in doubles. Great, great family, I think, even
absolutely.
Though I ended up on the wrong side of the,
yeah,
the recruiting
absolutely.
Stuff.
Their mother, but, their parents are great. Very
you know,
simple people.
I was so impressed with where they came from in Owensboro and what they were, what their parents were able to lead them into doing.
Exactly.
You know, you talked about, it gave you a platform.
Mm-hmm.
The university gave you a platform. The indoor building gave you a platform. And you talked about the rising stars. And, you know, when I heard your speech at the Hall of Fame, you talked about your work in the rising stars. What was that, you know, for our listeners?
It was something that I wish every city had and every city should. And I hearken back to my It Takes a Village before Mrs. Clinton said it about how to get a kid out of park and it's something they're good at. They might have an actual talent for it, whether it be softball, whether it be track and field, whatever. And again, those FSU students had to be in the park, so we had supervision in their specialty too. But I was a minority participation director for the state of Kentucky, which is a mouthful, from the USTA. And I had maybe $1,000 budget, which is might as well be $1.
Uh-huh.
And we had West End, we had Chickasaw, we had Berrytown, we had basically Newburgh, which sometimes calls Peterson Park. So we had four other little fingers, and here I am trying to be a thumb. And Mr. Sam Miller was a good friend of mine, and Judy Miller, they both played tennis. And they met us at a meeting we had at the old USTA building on Tellezer Road with Julie Peck, the president, and it's pouring down rain. And some other people were there, two other African-American, a couple that met with us from Berrytown. Ridiculously, I'm so embarrassed, I can't remember their name. But we are sitting in this little rain-soaked room, and we're trying to come up with a concept of how my impression from another very sage person who told me this, Mr. Miller, said, you know, kid, if we can get these four little parks to be willing to join together, we can do more as a fist than we can more as four individual fingers. So we became this little program called the Rising Stars. We only named that, Dennis, because I kid you not, on the wall of this rinky-dink little office was one of these Up With People posters or something. And instead it has these five stars shooting out, and it said Rising Stars. Which is one of those 1980s, 90s posters that you see. And so he said, that's a really apt name. So we chose that. I don't know if it's copyrighted. We don't care. We took it. And so we brought all these little parks together, and we're able to get the USTA in Atlanta to give us more money because we now were an entity. We were an LLC, if you will. And so we were able to get more money put into the programs, and that way all the other parks, all these other organizations got more money to put into their programs. And we were representing basically my young life, which is a socioeconomically disadvantaged kid. Well, just skip the crap. It's just poor, and that's okay. So you have some poor kids, but they're pretty talented, and you put them on a court, you put them on a track, you put them on a softball field, you teach them how to play the guitar, name that tune, and you aspire to inspire them to do better as a person, to do better as a young person, and to learn something that you literally could play all your life, just like golf, with all due respect. So I found tennis to be not only a wonderful sport because I played it, but little kids can learn pretty quick. They can also watch other kids playing. Well, I'm not the worst one out here, but I'm not the best. So there's that equanimity factor, which I think is huge in tennis. Because if you're just always the best or you're always the worst, you want to quit because you don't think you're going to get any better. So junior little kids tennis, I think, is good because they see other kids that don't do as well. And also, kids are pretty kind. Kids will say, that's okay, Billy, you'll get the next one. I mean, there's that payback too. But so we started the Rising Stars program, received a lot more in grants and funds, and let each park do its own thing. And to this day, West End still has their program, and Rising Stars has theirs. Rising Stars had to be based out of Newburgh. It doesn't mean that the West End can't participate in some of those same group settings. But as a group, we have to have the money funneled to something. And they all admit that's one of the biggest places to gather. They do have eight courts. A lot of these places, the West Louisville one had Shawnee a long time ago, and unfortunately they tore their courts down, which is mm-hmm. chilling. And then they started using Central Park, which is fine. Just was a transportation issue by getting people from Portland to Central Park. That wasn't really fair anymore because that's several miles this way to get to Central Park because they took the kids' courts away from Shawnee, which is heartbreaking for us. So West Louisville is beginning to play more out of Central Park. And as a result, the Rising Stars to this day has award-winning. They have a little contest that the USDA puts on called the Arthur Ashe Award, and they most often have young writers coming out of that. They tell people all over the country what tennis has meant to them, and oftentimes Newburgh Park produces one of those young people, and they get an all-expense trip paid to New York, which is amazing. They have the U.S. Open for a week. I think it's maybe 3 days, but such an inspirational experience. They bring that back to their friends and say, wow, you could try to do this. And so it's like dropping a stone and just watching the waves, just watching it wave out.
Now, Charles Crawford, did he do this with you?
He wasn't in the beginning of it. It was something that a good friend of mine and a scary mentor of mine, everybody will tell you that Dee Maynard is pretty high pressure.
Uh-huh.
She told me, kid, you're doing too much. You're spinning too many plates. Let somebody else take it that has a vested interest in continuing what you started. She goes, the great sign of a leader is when you establish something that's successful, let it go. And then use your expertise and your effort and your sweat equity to do something else. Like I did a lot with autism, or then I did a lot with wheelchair, whatever. But so, poof, it's off and running. So Charles and, you have to get to cut the tape on this one because I blew a name. Bruce Stone, those two just ran with it. They do great things, and it's continuing to do great things. And all the families that have had their kids grow up for it now are giving back. And I think the NICE Alliance, they've made the biggest improvement in just not only teaching the juniors, and a lot of them, is they teach the parents. And so when the parents can come over and play with the kids, instead of sitting there going, I'm going to wait for 2 hours for my kids' tennis, they now play. And then it's just muddled into all kinds of new USTA players and new entry-level USTA teams. And I think adding the adult package was brilliant.
So did Robin White come out of that Rising Stars program?
Yes, she did. Mm-hmm.
So she comes out of that program, goes to Louisville, plays number one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to say, becomes probably one of the leaders of Kentucky tennis now.
Yes, exactly.
You know, or certainly seems like her star is on the rise.
Exactly.
In the Kentucky Tennis Association circles. Is there anybody else like Robin that you can think of?
There are a few other kids. Charles' kids, Charles's son and daughter, both wanted to play small college tennis, I think, in this state, and went on to get a great education and did, like, teaching overseas and made it quite the program. Not as far as a lot of people didn't maybe stay with it long enough to play the colleges around here for college tennis. I know a couple of kids, I think, played at Midway and maybe Council College, which is now a university. Uh-huh. But, I mean, they may have gotten a partial scholarship, but it sure helped with the bills. You know, it sure helped them move on and be able to get a college education. I just could not name very many because I haven't been the leader of that for probably since, I'd say, 20. When COVID hit, Charles really had it and had it a little bit before that as well. And so I'm just trying to make sure monies are funneled. And I do think there's one thing that's very good that we helped them with, and that is nothing to me was more embarrassing as a junior player than to have on perhaps the wrong tennis attire. And as much as you say it doesn't matter anymore, yes, it does, especially for women.
Uh-huh.
And you guys might get to wear some shorts and a shirt probably, and it doesn't mean you have to have a tennis dress, but you probably aren't going to wear cutoffs or decent shorts and whatever for women. So my ladies and all over the city, we collect gently used clothing, gently used clothes, gently used shoes, and especially a lot of rackets. And I'll put new grips on them and string them off, and off they go. So I don't want to ever have a kid pay for a racket, and I don't want a kid to go to a tournament and feel like they're dressed in something that doesn't match. And so they get these glorious outfits now that many of them have the tag still on them. And my friends, I'm just like, you have the price tag on this. Like, that's okay, go ahead. And so they'll just give me, so it's a 24/7, never goes away, 365 thing. And I think we lay them out on big tables. The kids get all the clothing they need. So if they go play in a novice tournament, or they have these really neat ATA tournaments with the Tennis Association, when they come in, they're well-heeled and they look nice, and it just makes you feel better. And so that's something that's one less expense those kids have to manage, and the parents don't have to worry about how to go get them a tennis outfit. And I think it's a good thing. It's a great program. My ladies feel good about participating in the program, and they know that the young ladies are going to get well-dressed. We do have men's clothes as well, not as many, because it's just easier for the guys. You know, you guys can wear a decent pair of pants, and it's just different. But for women, I don't want the girls to feel lesser than, because they're not. Because that happened to me, a traumatic experience happened to me at Naples Bath and Racquet, and it's something that sears into your memory that, okay, I'm going to make it through this day, but never, ever will anybody I know have that heartache of being looked at like you're lesser than because of your attire.
Right.
So we fix that.
So you're doing now a lot of stuff with autism, and
we have, you know, up until COVID, we had an autism camp at U of L, and also a wheelchair tennis camp and a Down syndrome camp. Well, unless you have an indoor facility that can help you do all that pro bono, it's hard to keep up with. But I do want to start it next year again. I have Standard Country Club, but those particular groups often can't be in the sun too much. Medication-wise, I can't. Uh-huh. So in that sense, we're trying to get some deals maybe with Springhurst, maybe with the new Genesis Tennis Club, because you have to have indoor tennis to pull those off, right, for those camps. And so we're looking into that. It's just that after COVID, everything, from their point of view, they couldn't even transport their kids. Everything sort of got shut down. And we have certainly brought tennis to them to some degree, but we like to get them out of their building and into another site and make it feel like they do go to a camp. It's just twice a week, and it's an hour and a half, but it gives the parents just a respite, just a chance to read a book and maybe hang out with their other two or three kids they might have. And the autism kids are... they're just a wonderful group to work with. The Down syndrome kids were just a riot. And the wheelchair kids, those are not so much a camp because we don't have enough of them. I just teach wheelchair kids personally, and that's never going to stop. But as far as forming the camps from the Down syndrome and the autism programs, we like to get them back in the mix. I'm just going to guilt one of these tennis clubs into it and get some pro bono court time, or ask our rising stars, our Raise a Racket people to help us out. And I haven't done that yet. I probably could have, so it's not their fault. It's just that the timing wasn't good, that to get the kids all there, and they've gone into some other things like fun things like horseshoes and square dancing and all that. And so I'll eventually get them back into outdoor sports. So,
you know, Meg, you're obviously, this is a podcast and it's not a video, but you have an Athletes in Action shirt on, mm-hmm. Okay? Do you view your coaching as a ministry in any way?
Absolutely do think it's a ministry. I don't have my great friend Rich Benson gave me the shirt, and so I'll wear it when I can, and wish I had more of them. And it just seems like that was an interesting thing that he helped lead and mentored through and what have you. We chatted about it a few days, and I do think that tennis is not obviously a religion, but it does teach you morals. Honesty is one of them, integrity, self-respect, kindness, integrity. I said that twice, but I didn't know what that word was when I was a kid. But just that sense of you're out there and you're looking around for a scorekeeper, because all the other games you had, whether it be soccer or softball, has somebody saying out, no good, go away. And suddenly you're out there by yourself, and the young man, the 71-year-old minister, said, now you're out here by yourself, and you have to call your own lines, and, you know, if they're good, they're good. If they're not, and if you can't tell, then the person gets the point. And that only had to be told to me once. I just thought that was how you played. And so I think that those lessons that tennis gives you, it doesn't mean you have to be a very good player, but you can be an amazing person. You can have a joyous time. You can hit some shots that are just amazing. Like, how did I do that? You can also hit a tree, which is also hard to do, but it's fun. And you can have the joy of just another kid your age. That doesn't have to be an animosity situation where you're just playing because it's fun, the joy of playing, just to go do something. And yes, there's a score. But there has to be a score for anybody to move on in a tournament. And you also want to have a score against your friend, because you're going to say, I'm going to beat you today, Billy. And you may not, but at least you can try. And so there's that sort of the ministry of tennis, I think, is also that you have so many people who don't think they can make a difference. By giving me that clothing they gave me, those ladies helped me make a difference. By coming out and helping with the junior clinic in those autism camps, I have people to this day keep saying, when are you going to have those? I'd like to come help. When are you going to have the Down syndrome comes back? They're all right. I'd like to come help. These are people that could have the care in the world to do this. But I know that they received way more back from helping than the kids may have received. They just think of it as another camp. I mean, they enjoy it. But the ladies and gentlemen who helped me do this, whether it be college kids, whether it be high school kids that I had to get their service hours in, or whether it just might be my adult friends, all to a person came back and said, that was incredible. I feel so inspired. You know, what else can I do? And then that to me is like, again, the drop in a bucket. You drop a stone and here comes the ripples. And and they might go out and do something else that I don't even know that they're doing, and I don't care to know. But I just think that tennis is a vehicle because of its empathy and its integrity and its honesty, and to me, it's grace. Tennis is always very gracious as much as it is graceful.
I have two more questions for you. We'll finish up here. You received the U of L Athletic Hall of Fame Award and the Louisville Bell Award with Denny Crum.
Yeah,
my
kid.
Of all people.
I kid him. I used to kid him about that. We went into the Hall of Fame together, and my friends were like, when they saw the program, they thought, yeah, I'll go on that. Are you going for me? Or are you going to see Coach Crum? Oh, no, no, it's for you. I'm like, but had he not been there, would he? Well, yeah, probably. You know, they kid me. You know, they kid me. But, I mean, I know that the room was huge. You know, the Brown Williams room was like end to end. My friends are like, wow, Meg, this is impressive. I'm like, did you see the program yet? It's really about Coach Crum. It's not about me, and I think there's another volleyball player. Robbie Valentine got in the same year, so we kid ourselves about, yo, look who's in the room. Oh, you mean me? No, behind you, you know, Coach Crum. So we kid him. And then so the Bell Award, walked into the room, and I knew Denny was in it. And they took up the huge, beautiful, I've been so blessed to have my Hall of Fame, as you know, in the beautiful seal box. I mean, the most muckiest Hall of Fame we've ever had was me. And then in the Omni, which is where we had their ballroom, was the Bell Awards. And it has a gorgeous ballroom and huge. And WLKY is all there, and it's all beautiful. And we sat with the weatherman and somebody else. And my friends are like, wow. So I went up to Susan, gave her a hug, and said, hey, Coach Crummy. He goes, how you doing, baby? He gives me a hug. He goes, I said, now, I got to tell you, I told Susan, do you have to keep hawking me? Because every time I get an award, you're always there.
Yeah.
And Susan's falling down the ground thinking it's just hysterical. And he goes, well, yeah. He goes, well, I follow great people. And, of course, at that, I'm mortified. I didn't even know if he got the gist of it. And I said, okay, I'm going to mumble my way over here. So just so you understand what happened, I had to follow in that particular Bell Award. Coach Crum gets up and he says, I'm sorry, I forgot my notes. We're like, we don't care if you talk about popcorn. We don't care. We don't care. My turn came after, I'm not kidding, gulp. My turn came after the person who has put a bus together with the people who were killed in Carrollton on that bus crash.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't hear a pin drop. I have to follow him.
Yeah.
My friend grabs my leg, Karen Hamilton, she goes, good luck, kid.
Good luck.
Like, oh, my God. So and people are kind of clapping, sort of, because they're so woebegone because of what they just had to hear. And clearing me, I'm like, I can't even speak, right? So I get up, and I had taken the back of the program, just the back cover. You know me, I'm always trying to make stuff up because I got to do something. And so I get up to the podium, and I'm not going to tell you everything I said because we haven't enough long enough time. But basically, you know, wheelchair kids that started to play tennis and whatever. So I get up and I have the program and I ripped it up and I threw it up the pieces. And I said, like Coach Crum said, who needs a speech? And of course it just brought the house down because it like broke some of the ice and it made people laugh like, who's this crazy girl saying that? But I had to think of something because I don't think I could have even given a speech because I was so awestruck and dumbfounded. And that's just a very difficult thing. And if you're from Kentucky and you were anywhere in life when that happened, to understand what happened,
right,
no one will ever forget it. And right. So to think this guy takes this drunk driving bus and goes around to schools and says, you see these people? They didn't make it. And so I have to follow that. So like I said, it was very difficult. But to Coach Crumsfeder, when he didn't have the notes, I just walked up and thought, I said, guess what? They don't know that it wasn't my notes, which is the program. And I threw it up in the air and said, like Coach Crum. Like he said, who needs notes? And so I just made stuff up on the fly, which you can tell I do. But it was a great evening, and so many people came up, and I was so grateful for the USTA to have nominated me. I didn't even know who nominated me, but Jason Miller did. And I'm still dumbfounded that I received that, because to me, that is a very civil award that some, like the movers and shakers of Louisville get, not so much monetarily, but just do things behind the scenes, like go make some beds or go build some houses that isn't Habitat, that doesn't get all that, that are just people that do go feed a food bank or go, you know, and you hear these people like, how in the hell am I in this audience or how am I part of this? Because these people seem so much more significant in impact than me. And my friends are like, no, not really, but they just, everybody has their niche. So,
well, let's circle back around here now at the end. Let's circle back around to you get in the Kentucky Tennis Association Hall of Fame. And as I told you, a great moment, I thought, you know, for in terms of those Hall of Fame inductions. What did that mean to you? You know, because you got into the Hall of Fame, you know, 21 years coaching at U of L, but also all these community projects that you had done, all the people that you taught, you know, tennis over the years, your playing career in the state at U of L. What did it mean to you when they called you and they said, you're going in the Hall of Fame?
First of all, I thought they were kidding because I thought you had to be from here. I thought you had to be a Louisvillian or a Kentuckian because I just thought you did. So I thought, well, that's nice, but seriously.
Well, we claim you.
Seriously, so, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you know. I've been here way more in my life than I was in Florida. But in any event, my friends in Florida are like, we need to get you in our Hall of Fame. I'm like, well, you better get the hell started because, you know, time's a-wasting, but there's that. But the idea that that I was so impressed and so, again, sort of thinking I was being punk because I thought you had to be from here. But it meant a lot because I was still coaching U of L. This was in 2005. I just finished coaching, but I was just running the tennis center and doing a bunch of things. And just the idea that when I got, the funniest thing was, if you recall, when you were saying about the standing ovation, which I was dumbfounded with, and Dr. Swigert, bless his heart, with his yellow legal pad turning, and Dr. Swigert, I needed a hook to pull him off the stage. Remember that? I'm like, Doc, you can stop. Doc, you can stop. In 1942, she won so-and-so. I'm like, Dr. Phil, you can stop. And so he's, you know, has his yellow page, and he was bound and determined to finish. And finally, I think Judy Miller said, Dr. Swigert, that's enough. He goes, oh, okay. And he says, I think Jackie said, sit down, Dick, that's enough. So I walk up, and of course, Blanche Wibbles stands up on the table back in the back and screams out, we love you, Meg. And of course, at that point, people are drinking way too much. And I'm like, oh, dear God. And the old people turn around. They think they heard her say that, but they can't tell the people in the front. And so at that point, it sort of you know, broke the house down. But I was very impressed that my 41 tennis players from UL had hit in the back, didn't even know they were there. And they pop out on the way, because one of my young ladies said, Kelly Wertler, who lives there, says, because you have to go to the restroom. I'm like, no, don't you have to go? No, not really. Yeah, you do. So I went back in there in the hallway. I about flipped out. They were all waiting in the hallway. So that
41
was
41 former,
players. Yeah, from my players' house. So that was impressive. And Blanche is over there doing a tea dance on the table, and the people are standing up. And so I don't know how I made that speech to us. I think I blacked out. But somehow the SNH green stamp kind of stuck in, and the evangelical minister kind of stuck out, and those kind of things. But just because I think people are – everybody's story is so genuine to how they got started, and you can't make it up. It had to have happened that way. But I think that I didn't know it was such a rare moment, but Dr. Swigert said he had been to several and not seen the whole hall get up quite that quick. He calls it a hall. I guess they were back in halls, back on halls back in the day. But he was very quick to point out that he goes, this is how much impact you've had, and you don't even realize it. And he said, and I want you to make sure that you understand you're not done. And that was, bless his heart, when he passed away, it was one of the most heartbreaking things in my life because he was like a second dad. And he, I don't know how he took such a shine to me, but he did. But I think he said, and you can cut most of this out, I think he said that it was my one-handed backhand. He says, you had a one-handed backhand and an overhead that I've never seen a woman hit like that. I said, well, no, remember, Laura Martin is way better than I am. She was like the bomb. She was like, you know, and I would only beat her, Dennis, because I could make her mad. I could piss her off and make her just go nuts. And she'd bang her hand on the ground. She'd get furious, and I could beat her because she had a bad temper. When she didn't have a bad temper, it was not a good day because she could shred you if she wanted to. But I just think that him saying that was priceless to me. You know, as he sat down, he goes, you know, this is what the people think of you, and this is how much you've done. He goes, and you're not finished. You know, and I took that to heart, and it was a very impressive moment for me. And so it was fun.
I think that's a good place to finish.
I do too.
And I cannot, Dr. Swigert, you know, what a great way to sum up your career.
Yeah, it was.
He said, just perfect.
Just perfect.
You know, the way he summed it up. And thank goodness, as he said, there's more to come.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Meg.
Thanks.
We really appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.